This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are people who simply refuse to believe that the climate is changing or that we have anything to do with it. But climate scientists have been ringing alarm bells for years and have also tried to alert policymakers to the threat posed by rising sea levels. Those warnings are no longer theoretical. The effect of climate change and rising seas is already being felt, particularly in areas along the East and Gulf coasts. According to William Sweet, a scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a leader in research on coastal inundation, once impacts become noticeable, they're going to be upon you quickly. It's not 100 years off. It's now. Yet policymakers seem to have tuned out these warnings. Until recently, North Carolina had a law forbidding communities from passing ordinances based on reports warning of rising sea levels. At the federal level, lawmakers have also turned a blind eye, even as the government spends billions of taxpayer dollars in ways the New York Times alleges add to the risk by subsidizing local government and homeowners who build in imperiled locations along the coast. Because our coastline is particularly vulnerable to the threat of rising sea levels, we wanted to get a clearer picture of where things stand and find out how our coastal communities are preparing for an uncertain future. And that is why Dr. Rob Young is back with us. He is a professor of coastal geology and director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University and an expert on coastal erosion and climate change. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You can join us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. That's email, through Facebook, or on Twitter. And, of course, we're broadcasting this morning on Facebook Live. In 2010, you were the co-author of a report for North Carolina's Coastal Resources Commission that predicted sea levels along our state's coastline could rise by as much as 39 inches by the end of the century. I've seen other figures since then. So are you sticking with the 39-inch figure there?
Well, again, that was, you know, an average estimate. Right. Could be a little bit less, could be a little bit more. But I think that figure is still probably reasonable.
Okay. That's 3 feet, 3 inches for those who haven't figured that out yet. And that may be difficult for people to picture in reality. I mean, we know what a yardstick looks like. But what does that mean along the coast? Does that simply mean that the waves are going to lap up three feet higher on the shore? Or that, in fact, if the lowest sand dune is 3 feet tall, it's going to be at water level. What does that mean?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is that it means that the map of the coast of eastern North Carolina is going to look very different with 3 feet of sea level rise than it does right now.
So what would it look like? What's going to happen?
The slope of the coastal plain in far eastern North Carolina is about 1 to 10,000. So for every 1 foot of elevation gain, you move 10,000 feet landward. So if you lift sea level 3 feet, it means that the water table under all of those far eastern counties is coming up also about 3 feet, which increases flooding, nuisance flooding, makes agriculture a little bit more difficult. It also means that you're going to increase the rate of erosion on the shoreline dramatically. And the barrier islands themselves, so Cape Hatteras, Cape Lookout, Nag's Head, Kitty Hawk, Kill Devil,
Duck,
Bogue Banks, Duck.
We're going to talk to the town manager of Duck in a little while. Go ahead.
They're not going to be in the same place that they're in right now.
What does that mean?
That means that barrier islands are very dynamic places. They're not made of rock. They're made of sand. They want to move. And so when you raise sea level, it drives all of our coastal environments, the shoreline, the barrier islands, the estuaries, the marshes, everything tries to move landward in response to that rising of the ocean level. Mm-hmm. And if there's no infrastructure or people in the way, that's not a big problem. Sea level rise and coastal erosion is not an issue for these coastal environments. We have to remember that 15,000 years ago, which is just like yesterday to a geologist, we were at the end of the last ice age. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the water that is now in the oceans was actually in these great ice sheets that covered Europe and covered North America. So sea level on the East Coast and globally was 300 feet lower than it is now. And our shorelines were miles further out to sea. And since then, it's all moved into its current location. But the beaches are still there. The estuaries are still there. The marshes are still there. These natural environments can take care of themselves in response to rising sea level. The problem comes when we try and build on them.
Because they migrate and reestablish themselves.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? So let's go back to that 1 in 10,000 figure. Give me that one more time.
The average slope of the eastern North Carolina coastal plain east of Raleigh is 1 to 10,000.
Which means, again, for every
– So if you – for every – in order to gain 1 foot of elevation, you need to go 10,000 feet landward.
So if the sea is going to go up 3 feet in – but by the end of the century, you're talking about 5 miles.
Essentially. Now, you know, it's not quite that simple because the sand moves around and it reconfigures itself. And in some places it can build higher and form beaches and beach ridges. But basically, yes.
So you've also said that governments, businesses, and homeowners should assume that the world's oceans will rise by at least 2 meters, which is 7 feet. If I'm not mistaken, am I mistaken? Because I'm not a metric guy. in this century, that's more than twice what you said in 2010. And you say that's not a prediction, but the most prudent, conservative, long-term planning guideline for coastal cities and communities.
So I think what that means it means that we should be thinking about what happens if sea level comes up 6 or 7 feet by the end of the century. And you know, what does that mean? If you're building a beach house in a single family home, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square feet, how they build them these days, it may not mean anything to you because you're looking for a return on your investment that might be 5 years, 10 years or something like that. But if you're building a nuclear power plant or a port facility or something that is very permanent infrastructure, you need to seriously consider this much longer term window for rising sea level. So, you know, I don't want anybody to think that these projections that we may have a significant amount of sea level rise by the end of the century are suggesting that anybody should abandon the coast, you know, tomorrow, pick up all your homes, pick up the roads and leave. That's not what it's all about. I think that those projections are primarily designed to make people think about the decisions they're making for new development, new infrastructure, rebuilding after storms, and you know, let's not do any more harm or put any more things in places that are at risk.
But if you build a single family house, I mean, it would seem to me that if people know that climate change is going to cause a rise in sea level at some point in the future, and we're not sure exactly when, but according to that quote that I read earlier in the program, it's now, not 100 years from now. It's happening now. Won't your property value start declining? I mean, you can build that great house or even a shack because you want to go to the beach every weekend. But the property value is bound to decline as this becomes more apparent to more people. Isn't that accurate?
Well, it's complicated. You know, at the moment, the federal and state government pump a lot of subsidies into allowing people to continue to build and rebuild in hazardous areas.
Right.
You know, we do this through a variety of different mechanisms, and that tends to support the property values of coastal property. So, you know, I think you're right that in areas that are particularly vulnerable to coastal erosion, coastal storms, and ultimately sea level rise, that at some point it's going to become unsustainable, and then those property values will crash. But at the moment, we seem to be able to continue to support those property values. The real estate market at the coast in most places is still doing fabulously. And that's part of the problem because it's masking this underlying issue.
And I have to pose this question. How many scientists such as yourself who deal with sea level rise take the approach you've taken so far in this hour? The reason I ask is because you don't sound like this is any great urgency. There's no great urgency to this. You just want people to be aware of it and maybe change policy to make it make more sense in the long term. But you're not saying that the sky is falling. And is that part of the problem, getting people to react to this in a way that might save us money down the road?
Well, you know, I like to believe that I'm a person that is trying to find meaningful solutions to these long-term problems of coastal management. And walking into a room and telling everybody the sky is falling, and it's time to leave is not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
You know, the first step in responding to long-term sea level rise in any community, including communities in North Carolina, is to wisely manage the coast right now for the hazards that we know exist, the next storm. And we still don't do that very well. So, you know, I think that it does not help to be alarmist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really even like to talk about sea level rise at projections to the end of the century anymore, because the political lifespan of most politicians is a 2-year cycle, 4-year cycle, maybe 6-year cycle. And the planning horizon for most communities is 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road. So we need to talk about things that they can do over these shorter time cycles that will ultimately make a difference in the long run if we want to find practical solutions.
So back in 2010, when you co-authored that report on North Carolina's coastal situation for the Coastal Resources Commission, what was the reaction among lawmakers and policymakers and development people along the coastline to that report?
Well, they weren't very happy with the number. Anybody who...
But why?
Well, I think they were very concerned that it was going to impact property values, the tax base, that it was going to slow coastal development and impact the coastal economy in general.
Hmm. And therefore, no action was taken? Is that what you're telling me? Did it in fact lead to that law that is now off the books that forbid communities from making any adjustments based on climate or sea level rise predictions?
So to be clear, the law did not forbid local communities from taking local action.
Mm-hmm.
It did prevent state agencies from any new rulemaking related to possible acceleration in the rate of sea level rise.
Did that stem from your report?
Yeah, I think it was a reaction to our report.
How do you explain that? I mean, you're telling people that not the sky is falling, but there's a crack in the stratosphere here, which we ought to be aware of. And they're saying, no, we can't be aware of that.
It was an unfortunate reaction. You know, to some degree, you know, I understand it. It was initiated by the Coastal Resources Commission, the request for the report. You know, it wasn't initiated by the scientists. The scientists didn't walk in and say, hey, we want to write a report for you about sea level rise to the end of the century. The Coastal Resources Commission requested the report. And I think the lawmakers were caught a little bit off guard by the science of rising sea level. And that was their response.
The Union of Concerned Scientists has predicted that by 2035, which, by the way, is 13 years from now, that's all it is, 13 communities on the mainland side of the Pamlico Sound will be chronically inundated. That means 10% of that area's usable land will flood at least 26 times a year. That's every other week, by the way. By 2060, that number of communities rises to 25. By 2100, the next century, the people in 49 mainland side communities will have to adapt to rising water or move. And that is based on intermediate predictions, not the worst-case scenario of what is likely to happen. What has been the reaction to that? I only have 30 seconds, but what's been the reaction to that?
It certainly has gotten a lot of media attention. That report focused on communities up and down the East Coast, so there's been a lot of reporting on it. And I think that it's important for people to understand that rising sea level is something that's impacting inland communities,
right,
as well as the ocean front, because, as I mentioned earlier, the water is coming up under these places. It makes the stormwater hard to run off.
We'll talk more about that as we go through the hour here with Dr. Robert Young, professor of coastal geology and director of the Program for Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Urgent Vet Pet Clinic, providing veterinary urgent care 365 days a year for Charlotte pet owners. Locations now open in Fort Mill and Belmont. Your pet can't wait to feel better. More info at urgentvet.com. And Veritas Collaborative, providing a continuing education series on eating disorders for healthcare professionals in Charlotte on Friday. Information and details at veritascollaborative.com/events. You know Kathy Reichs, right? Well, the first time Kathy Reichs joined us, she was a UNC Charlotte forensic anthropology professor who had just begun to write novels with roots in her own scientific experience. To date, She has written 24 books featuring her alter ego Temperance Brennan, which gave rise to the enormously popular TV series Bones. Well, she's now created a new heroine who favors a gun over a microscope. And we'll explore this new adventure with her tomorrow at 9.
Chefs who need exotic and hard-to-find ingredients are turning to refugees, farmers who know how to grow them.
We're able to sort of highlight a skill they bring to the United States and give restaurants access to locally grown food like that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a gardening win-win, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about rising sea level and what that will mean to our coastal areas and also some of the inland areas as the sea level begins to rise. Dr. Robert Young is with us. He's a professor of coastal geology and the director of the Program for Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to hear from the town manager of Duck, North Carolina. That's out on the Outer Banks. And they are already taking precautions because they're seeing the effects. I don't want to put words in his mouth. We'll have him talk about that a little bit later on. I would think that part of the problem here is getting ordinary people, not just policymakers and lawmakers, to understand what we're talking about and what the implications of this are, because they look at these varying predictions of sea level rise being anywhere from 2 to 7 feet in places, and that's because scientists are making a very educated guess. Is that right? You're saying it's happening, but you're not exactly sure where the ruler will be.
That's correct.
Okay, so scientists are guessing. That would mean that policymakers would have to guess on their response if they decided to do something. So is that impeding any response? Because they don't want to have to guess wrong. They don't want to guess wrong.
Well, you know, again, I think that the primary message for both individuals and policymakers is the first way to begin to address sea level rise and long-term climate change is not to focus on the prediction for what will happen by the end of the century. You know, you talk to a group of policymakers and planners about that, and their eyes just sort of glaze over because they're not going to be around for that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to focus on what's going on right now. And all the coastal erosion that we're experiencing up and down the east coast of the U.S., like the reason why Duck, North Carolina, needs to pump up a new beach is a result of rising sea level. And sea level's been rising for the last century and a half. This isn't something new. Sea level rise is what drives coastal erosion. And what people can do is wisely address that existing coastal erosion and storm vulnerability. Make sure that we're not putting houses in places that are going to get knocked down by the next hurricane, and that when we rebuild, we're not rebuilding in areas that are vulnerable to the next hurricane.
And we are doing that in some locations.
Following
now.
Hurricane Sandy, we put everything back right where it was. We may have lifted it up just a little bit because federal flood insurance requires communities and individuals to raise property above a flood elevation, but we basically spent $60 billion of federal money to put homes, roads, power grid, everything back right where it was. Now, that's dumb. And we had this big opportunity to change the map of the coast a little bit, not to evacuate the barrier islands and destroy the coastal economy, but to selectively not rebuild in those areas that have had repeat damage from storms. And we passed on that opportunity. And if we had done that, not only would we have been adapting to the next storm, but we would have been adapting to sea level rise in a way that's slow and manageable and won't damage the coastal
and
economy.
You've changed your approach when you talk about this to most lay people. You go now into communities and talk about storm hazards, flooding after heavy rains, and what you just talked about, coastal rebuilding, rather than about sea level rise. Why? Is because that's readily recognizable and easy to understand, and people experience it in their everyday life. You can't see sea level rise because it happens so slowly over time. Is that right? Is that why?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, sea level rise is fairly abstract to people who aren't, you know, busy measuring it every day. And I think that it's better to talk about the hazards that people have experienced and understand. And in addition to that, you know, let's face it, sea level rise and climate change is a hot button partisan issue these days.
Yeah.
And
do you understand why? Because it's going to affect everybody, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. So why is it a hot button issue?
Well, that's a long story. We might have to do another show on that one.
Right.
I don't want to try to put myself in the heads of those who are skeptics.
There. Around the country, more than 90 U.S. communities already face what you're talking about here, chronic flooding. There are islands in the Chesapeake Bay near the Delmarva Peninsula that have disappeared or that appear to be taking on more water because the land is sinking. It's not just that the sea is rising. The land is physically sinking in some places. In Charleston, they are looking at raising the seawall along the Battery, spending billions of dollars. I think they're going to raise it 10 feet or something like that. It's said that North Carolina's coastline is one of the three most vulnerable places along the Atlantic seaboard to sea level rise after South Florida, Norfolk, Virginia. Don't these instances raise concerns among those who set policy here and elsewhere? They're seeing this happen. Communities are experiencing this.
Well, I think that in the communities where sea level rise is regularly causing nuisance flooding, and you know, you mentioned the Tidewater Virginia area, Norfolk, Miami-Dade County, Charleston. In these places, it is real and palpable to them, and they are taking action to adapt to it. You know, Charleston is spending tens of millions of dollars to completely reconfigure their stormwater runoff. And, you know, these are clearly adaptation actions towards sea level rise, and people talk about it that way, and it's bipartisan.
Is it something they'll win? If they do everything exactly the way they think they need to do it and spend all of this money to do it, will it work, or will they have to do it again in 50 years or 40 years?
It is not a long-term solution. However, you know, all of these places still have incredibly vital economies. I understand why people want to institute solutions, even if they know that it may be a 20-year, 30-year solution. There always is this small chance that the globe may wake up and decide to try and mitigate climate change and slow the rise of sea level.
Here's another question about why policymakers aren't more active in this. The military has already said, the Pentagon has already said that climate change is a threat to the security of the United States. They also see rising sea levels as a national defense threat because the naval base at Norfolk could go away with rising sea levels, or require billions of dollars to do whatever they have to do to keep that port open for ships. So why hasn't that rung alarm bells in Washington or elsewhere?
That's a very good question. And you're correct that the Department of Defense gets it, that, you know, they are concerned about changing climate and how it might destabilize certain sections of the globe and how it might impact their infrastructure and their bases in the U.S. As it turns out, most port facilities happen to be near sea level.
Yeah, about that.
and they don't have the luxury of being partisan. Their job is to protect their facilities, their infrastructure, and protect the United States of America. And so they get it. You know, the Navy has a climate change officer at a very high level. And I have suggested to him on a couple of times that, boy, he needs to march into the North Carolina legislature in full uniform and talk to the folks there about his position on the threat of climate change globally and to North Carolina.
In Norfolk, Virginia, which is where that naval base is located, the city of Norfolk has taken to placing vertical rulers in low spots to show people how deep water is during tidal flooding periods. You'll know not to drive down that street because that's not a puddle. It's 4 feet deep or whatever it is. Because they're experiencing increasingly what is called tidal flooding. What is tidal flooding?
So this means that when you get a spring tide or a moon tide, these unusually high tides that we have several times a year, the water comes into the city, and in some places it's actually coming up through the storm drains. It's not coming over the barrier or over the seawall or something like that. It's actually backing up through the storm water drainage system and flooding streets, flooding areas. This is happening in a number of municipalities up and down the East Coast, not just in Norfolk. It's particularly bad in the Norfolk, Virginia area, the Tidewater, Virginia area, which is, you know, why it's definitely caught their attention. You know, this is what's generally referred to as nuisance flooding, and it can happen when the sun's out. You know, you get the wind blowing in the wrong direction on a day when there's a slightly higher tide than normal, and you've got wet streets all over the place that you can't drive through. And this really is the leading inland edge of sea level rise that municipalities are going to have to spend a lot of money to deal with.
There's a long article recently in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about something that's happening on the Chesapeake Bay, and I've forgotten whether it's an island in Virginia or an island in Maryland, but the two states take different approaches to how they deal with this. But this particular island is facing extinction. It's been around for 400 years. People have lived on this island since the first settlers arrived, and their feet have been dry, but now they walk out into their backyards and it's like marshland. It's become wet all the time, never dries out. Maybe there's an inch of water higher than normal in some places. And they're saying this because partly of sea rise, but it's also because the islands are sinking. Is that true? The islands are actually sinking, or is it because the water's just getting higher? And what's going on there?
So you're speaking about Tangier,
exactly,
Island,
Tangier
Virginia,
Island,
which is in the Chesapeake Bay.
Maryland would have rescued it, but Virginia doesn't.
Well, I'm not sure it's possible to rescue it. It is true that what's going on in those Chesapeake Bay Islands is a combination of the land subsiding and sea level rising. Sea level rise is relative. So the degree of sea level rise you have depends on what your land surface is doing as well. So if you go down to Louisiana, for example, we have the highest rate of sea level rise in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's twice the rate of sea level rise in Norfolk in Louisiana because the land there is also subsiding at an even higher rate.
What's causing that?
In Louisiana, it's a combination of factors, sediment being shut off because of dams on the Mississippi River that used to keep the land surface elevated. Mm-hmm. All the weight of that Mississippi River delta is actually pushing it down into the earth. What's going on with sea level rise depends what's going on locally as well.
Are we experiencing any sinking lands in North Carolina?
Well, the northern Outer Banks of North Carolina has a higher rate of sea level rise than the beaches around Wilmington and south. And that is because the northern Outer Banks, as you get closer to the Virginia line, are experiencing that same, we scientists call it subsidence, or experiencing that same land subsidence that the Norfolk and Tidewater Virginia mm-hmm. area is. So there is a differential rate of sea level rise along the North Carolina coast.
Dr. Robert Young is our guest, but we're going to bring in somebody else into this conversation because we may have no federal policy addressing coastal erosion or sinking land or rising seas. We may have no real state plan, but local areas cannot blithely ignore the fact that the effects are already being felt. Some of those communities have begun to take action. One of them is the town of Duck, North Carolina. And joining us to share his community's approach is Chris Layton. He's the town manager in Duck, an area that could experience the highest sea level rise on the North Carolina coast, as much as 11 inches over the next 30 years. Chris Layton, thank you for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
Your town, for those of us people who can't put it in their mind's eye, has been described as this thin ribbon of sand surrounded by water on both sides. You've got the Atlantic on one side, and which sound is on the other?
The Currituck Sound.
Okay. How threatened do you feel right now?
To be honest, while we certainly are cognizant of sea level rise and reports such as those that have been written by Robert Young, as far as sort of seeing the impacts on a daily basis, we really don't see that sea level rise. Where we're really concerned about it, and where I think many coastal communities will start to see it, is with the impact of storm events. Mm. An inch of sea level rise is something that on a daily basis, we won't really, you know, you won't really see. But when you have a storm event and a storm surge and the impacts of that 1 inch over a huge area, you do start seeing, more severe erosion in areas. You do start seeing more impacts.
On your town website, you have written, "The town of Duck recognizes and monitors the dynamic coastal environment where the town is situated, located between the Atlantic Ocean and the Currituck Sound, in an effort to be proactive regarding the impacts to the coastline due to tides, erosion, and storm events. The town council has taken steps to better understand the changing shoreline and to effectively implement a shoreline management strategy for the entire town." You sound like you're ahead of the curve in terms of North Carolina, at least, and their reaction to this. Are you?
I certainly wouldn't go that far, and I wouldn't take that kind of credit. I think our reality is that we can take an approach that's more of adaptability and resiliency. The reality for us is our base flood elevation is, in most areas, we have obviously some higher areas, is roughly 7 feet. So if we were to wake up tomorrow, which of course we won't, but if we were to wake up tomorrow and have the seas have risen 7 feet, there wouldn't be much of Duck left. And so in terms of how we approach our infrastructure, we're not looking at doing things that large cities would do. Duck is 2.32 square miles.
Where do you get your water? Your drinking water?
Our drinking water is actually a regional system through Dare County.
So it comes from the mainland?
No, we are. Well, there are osmosis treatment plants and aquifer plants that supply the water, but it's part of a regional facility.
Because one of the questions that we were getting from a listener here on Twitter is, what about the threat of saltwater intrusion if the water table rises with sea level? Will this threaten drinking water supplies, not just on places like Duck, but on the mainland itself as the sea level begins to rise? Are you worried about that?
No, we aren't, because we are part of we are part of a system, and I think the only people that would need to be concerned about that kind of inundation would be people who are still on wells, and we don't have many of those people in Duck.
And we'll talk a little bit more about this a little bit later on in the program, Dr. Young, but what about that, this increasing salinity in fresh water supplies, whether they be drinking water supplies or inlets, et cetera?
That will be an issue in eastern North Carolina writ large. The salt wedge, or the salty part of the water, is moving inland up the estuaries. And for those inland communities that are getting their fresh water sources from the tidal rivers, it's definitely something that they're going to have to think about over the next couple of decades.
Wow. And that includes changes in vegetation along those estuaries. The grasses change, wildlife changes, trees die because they can't live in salt water, right?
Absolutely. If you go to eastern North Carolina and walk around, what you see is a landscape that's changing.
Dr. Robert Young is here from Western Carolina University. He's a sea level rise expert. Chris Layton is the town manager of Duck. We'll continue our conversation with both of them in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, providing brain and spine care for adults and children for over 75 years, welcoming physician and self-referred patients as permitted by insurance. Details at CarolinaNeurosurgery.com. And the Pump House Restaurant, featuring a Southern-inspired cuisine in a restored multi-level pump house with a rooftop bar, located at the Riverwalk in Rock Hill. More info at RockHillPumpHouse.com. The Republican health care push takes a step forward and then a step backward after a narrow vote to move ahead with debate. A plan to repeal and replace Obamacare failed in a late-night vote, with 9 Republicans rejecting the first of what will be many amendments put up for votes this week. A look at the Senate's full court press to pass something during On Point, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock.
It's your world. We help you explore it. Venezuela's opposition staged a vote yesterday, and one of the questions...
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Julie Eisholt said she thinks an MLS team would be great for Charlotte, but she told Smith she'd rather see public money go for a stadium in a neighborhood that's more in need of development.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Robert Young, professor of coastal geology and director of the Program for Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. And Chris Layton has joined us. He is the town manager of Duck, North Carolina, which is out on the coastline just north of Kitty Hawk and Killdevil Hills. Frank Gorham, the chair of the Coastal Resources Commission, favors leaving the problems that we may face because of rising sea levels to local towns and counties. And that means you, in Duck, do you feel the pressure? I mean, this is an expensive proposition you're looking at. Where's all this money coming from? You just completed a beach nourishment project that cost nearly $40 million. Where's all this money coming from?
Sure. Just to clarify, the $40 million was for a total project that included the towns of Killdevil Hills and Kitty Hawk as well as Duck. Duck's portion was just a little bit north of $14 million. As far as it being local implementation, we know in Duck that we're going to have to approach this issue. Not by ourselves, but more on a regional basis than a statewide or even a federal basis. Duck is a tourist community. We generate a lot of income, but we're not Norfolk or some other place where there's going to be a lot of federal money and state money likely to protect infrastructure. Mm-hmm. What happens to Duck in 100 years is something that is largely, I don't think, going to be something that the feds or the state invest in. What we do have at our disposal in our beach nourishment project is a good example. This was a locally funded project, and by that I mean there was no federal or state money involved in this project, and the funding came from local occupancy tax, so the people enjoying the beaches, renting the houses, paid for about half of the project, and then we issued special obligation bonds that are paid largely by the individual homeowners in the area where their nourishment project occurred. And so they paid for that and got been taxed extra to fund the repayment of those bonds. So all that money is local.
I misspoke a moment ago. Frank Gorham is the former chair of the Coastal Resources Commission. The current chair is Renee Cahoon. Has anything changed since she took over the commission in terms of the approach toward having local areas take care of this problem as opposed to the state?
Nothing concrete yet. I think Renee, who is also on the Outer Banks and is a member of the NAGS Head Council just south of us, I think her approach may be slightly different, but so far there haven't been any major policy statements that have come out yet.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, Dr. Young, but I think that you agree with the idea that if you're going to do things like nourish beaches that have eroded because of storm surge or because of the surf, that ought to come from local taxpayers and the stakeholders and developers, because you say that is something that will cause people to sit up and take notice as opposed to having it come out of a big pot of money they never see because it's a dollar off their income tax.
Right. I admire the way that the Northern Outer Banks communities have funded their beach nourishment project. I think that's generally the way that it should be done. It's a little bit unfair to them that there are many communities that do receive a tremendous amount of federal largesse mm-hmm. for their beach building projects. You know, the Corps of Engineers was given almost $5 billion following Hurricane Sandy to build beaches and coastal protection projects in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware. You know, and the only reason they got that money is because it was a sort of a knee-jerk reaction from Congress following the storm.
Duke University's Orrin Pilkey, who's a geology professor emeritus there, says in communities where this has happened over and over, this need to replenish the beaches, to re-nourish the beaches, it has led to further seaside development, and that ultimately these beach nourishment projects will fail to hold back rising seas. Chris Layton, are you aware of that study?
I'm aware of statements like that, and frankly, I don't disagree with what he's saying. I think what I would emphasize is that when we looked at our project, specifically in the town, and the council looked at this project, we said, does it make sense to invest the $14 million in this project, and can we sustain that for a period of time? What we ultimately determined is that we could afford to, with the help of the local occupancy tax, we could afford the project. The projects are designed for a five-year lifespan before they require maintenance. That can vary depending on storms. And so what we said when we developed our sort of funding plan and our plan for maintenance of it is, you know, can we get through a couple cycles with funding on hand? The answer to that question was yes. So by investing $14 million, are we going to be able to protect sort of the tax value of the rest of the town and the other things that a nourishment project would do, which is roughly $1.5 billion? And so for a very modest, you know, investment, would that sustain the tax base? And the answer to that was yes. Now, with sea level rise and climate change and other factors, we may reach a time, and if the studies are correct, which there's no reason to believe they aren't, we may reach a period where the answer to that question is no, that we can't afford anymore to do a project at the frequency that it requires for the same results. And that is the kind of adaptability model that the council is looking at, because at some point the answer to that question very well may be no, and then you have to go into a different mode. And that mode very well may be a retreat mode, which I would emphasize is not a no-cost mode. It's just a different approach.
Right. Dr. Young and I were speaking about the planning cycles that most towns go through, and they don't generally have a 20 or 25-year planning horizon because the life cycle of a city councilman or a mayor is 4 to 8 years. So do you have a 20 or 25-year plan to address this? Have you thought about it? Have you spoken about it?
We don't have a specific plan for 20 years. What our horizons are, we focus on our 10-year vision, and then we focus on our capital improvements plan as part of that. And that isn't to say that we don't have long-term plans. It's just that I can't pull up a spreadsheet that has, you know, a 20-year cycle on it. And a lot of that is going to be determined, again, the horizon that we're looking at. We know we can get through one or two renourishment projects. So we're really talking about 10 to 15 years where we can fund this. But a lot can change during that period, particularly with climate change, erosion patterns, that sort of thing.
And let's talk about your interaction with developers, because developers don't think that far out at all. They come in, they see an opportunity to plan something, build it, sell it, and they move on. And I don't think they care what's going to happen in 50 years, because they've sold the project 49 years before that and planned it 48 years before that, or 51 years before that. Do we have to rely on a buyer beware attitude among consumers going forward in these beach areas?
Well, I think that I talk often about there's a difference between the geologic time and what I call mortgage time. And what we're dealing with largely is mortgage time. People are focusing, when they buy their houses in a community like Duck, they're looking to see, you know, am I going to be able to maintain this property until the mortgage is paid? Mm-hmm. And that gets to what you're thinking about with developers. In terms of, I think we haven't turned that corner where the answer might be no yet. That's not in the in the common discussion that we may, you know, this house may not survive.
But do towns and city councils and people in charge, do they feel pressure from developers to do these beach renourishment projects or do things that perhaps in the long run won't be helpful, but in the short term would allow somebody to come in and put a piece of property together and sell it? Do you feel pressure to do things like that?
The pressure that we felt wasn't from developers. It was actually from homeowners.
Okay.
This was our project. We went through before we committed to this. We actually went through a full study where we looked at other options, including the retreat option, and all of that was organic. I mean, by that I mean the homeowners in the areas that were experiencing this erosion came to us and said, "Look, we can't hold this back by doing our own, you know, independent beach fill projects." We had people who moved houses back in their lots, and they said, you know, the erosion is just in this particular area is occurring such that we need you all to get involved. So it was an organic approach, not a developer approach. It was actually the homeowners and the people who actually are funding a large portion of the project who said, "You guys need to do something, and we're willing to pay for it."
Chris Layton is the town manager of Duck, North Carolina. Your feet are dry this morning, right?
They are.
Okay.
They are.
Just wanted to check. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're also here with Dr. Robert Young, professor of coastal geology at Western Carolina University. The New York Times says that flooding is the most common, most expensive natural disaster in the country. Private insurers have long declined to cover it, which leaves the government on the hook for disaster assistance after floods. And flooding will become increasingly more common if sea level rise predictions are correct. Has that become an incentive? Because the government's footing the bill for them to look at this, at least.
Well, it is one of the ways that the federal government continues to subsidize the development in hazardous areas. Now, the federal flood insurance program has a cap on the property values that they can insure of $250,000. So it's not subsidizing the McMansions and the oceanfront property to a large extent. But, you know, it is one of those sort of absurd incentives we have where the federal government is creating a kind of a moral hazard by stepping in where the private sector would never venture and providing insurance in places where people probably shouldn't be investing in building
but
and living.
But in a situation we're just talking about in Duck, where property owners took the initiative and the expense onto themselves to move their houses back a little bit on their lot lines as beach erosion became a problem, and where the taxpayers themselves are funding renourishment projects along the beach, that's as long as you want to pay the bill, that's viable, right?
Absolutely. And that happens in very few communities across the U.S. I mean, we track every beach nourishment project in the country as a part of what we do. And, we're building beaches from Maine to Texas. Mm-hmm. And those beaches are largely funded with public dollars, a mixture of federal and state dollars. Very few of them are entirely locally funded.
Is that a fool's errand in your mind, given what you know about the imminent or the eventual rise of sea level?
Well, it's unsustainable over the long run, clearly. We cannot continue to pretend that we're going to hold a beach in front of every stretch of shoreline in the U.S. East Coast and Gulf Coast. And because so many of these projects are federally funded and largely federally funded, the local governance doesn't have to put the same amount of thought into it that the folks in Duck obviously have about whether they can afford it or not. If the federal government is paying most of the bill, well, you don't have to think about anything really other than, where you're going to go for beer tonight.
You've said that the melting of the ice on Greenland and in the West Antarctica area are likely to be the most important source of sea level rise in the 21st century. We just saw that big sheet of ice break the size of Delaware break off of Antarctica. Is that what you're talking about here?
Well, the ice sheet that broke off was floating marine-based ice. So that actually, even if it all melts, isn't going to add to sea level rise because it was already sitting on the water. But what it portends is that the ice that's on land up behind it may start to flow more quickly towards the sea. Mm-hmm. And that's how you add water to the ocean.
Another of your colleagues, Brian Bula, who is a researcher at Appalachian State University, says that coastal officials may not be willing to prepare for climate change until it is too late. He says that although it would be less expensive to prepare before the impact is felt, they may not do anything until the threat is imminent. And by then, will it be too late or just too expensive?
Well, this is the way it works. We respond to financial incentives and we respond to financial pressures largely in the U.S. And as long as it makes more economic sense for people to rebuild in the same place because their risk is largely being subsidized by the public sphere, then people are going to continue to do the wrong thing until it is too late. And I think the way to preserve the coastal economy is to be a little bit more forward thinking.
So if these barrier islands disappear ultimately, if Kitty Hawk and Killdevil Hills and Duck go under the water or the sands are inundated, will the ocean then be at Oriental? Will that be a seaside community then?
So the barrier islands probably won't disappear. They will just become so dynamic that you won't be able to keep houses on them. Because they're moving, that's right. They narrow on the ocean side and on the sound side, and then they get overwashed during storms, right. And it'll just become difficult to keep roads and property out there. So the barrier islands will be okay over the long run.
And we didn't get a chance to talk about this, but rising sea levels don't just impact local communities, coastal communities. It'll have an impact on Charlotte. Wake and Mecklenburg County has said they could see 100,000 more residents as people move inland. That's not imminent. That's, 100 years from now?
That's probably a long-term projection, yeah.
So buy a house in the mountains, like you.
I think there are more people moving here from New Jersey right now than there will be from the coast.
Right. Dr. Robert Young is professor of coastal geology and director of the Program for Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. You really are far away from the ocean for a reason, I'll bet you. Thank you for the hour.